From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the war against pop music, videos, and lipstick in parts of the Middle East. In Iran, government-backed militias are patrolling the streets, confiscating materials that don't reflect Islamic teachings. In Egypt, the pyramids have even been on the hit list because they represent idolatrous culture. We talk with New York Times Middle East correspondent Chris Hedges. Also, we talk with Dr. Dean Ornish about his research into reversing heart disease through a non-fat diet and stress reduction. It's just become the first lifestyle heart program to win the approval of a major health insurance company for reimbursement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Mediators at the peace talks in Geneva say Serbian troops have not pulled back from a strategic mountain overlooking Sarajevo, but they still hope to restart the talks tomorrow. Bosnia's Muslim president has boycotted the talks until such a pullback was completed. A spokesman for the mediators told reporters that the co-chairmen were not satisfied that the Serbs had left the area. The Serbian troops were to have left the strategic positions and been replaced by United Nations peacekeeping troops. UN observers on the ground say that although some Serbian forces have moved, it's not clear if they were leaving or just moving to other positions on the mountain. U.S. soldiers in Somalia opened fire on a rally of about 2,000 people in Mogadishu today. Somali eyewitnesses say at least three people were injured. United Nations officials say the soldiers acted correctly by firing over the heads of protesters in an effort to dispel the crowd. The demonstrators were protesting against the presence of thousands of United Nations troops in the country. The BBC's Roger Hearing reports.
A demonstration near the city center was attended by well over 2,000 people protesting angrily at the actions of the UN in Somalia. As the crowd listened to speeches in praise of General Idid, a column of three American jeeps approached. They forced their way through the crowd and some stones were thrown at them. As the jeeps emerged from the crowd, the soldiers opened fire. It wasn't immediately clear whether the troops were firing over the heads of the demonstrators, but Somali eyewitnesses told me five people had been injured. Three people with arm and chest wounds were later brought to the journalist's hotel. UN helicopters flew very low over the crowd for up to an hour after the incident. Somalis at the scene complained that the Americans had created a deliberate provocation at a peaceful demonstration.
Roger Hearing reporting from Mogadishu. President Clinton was in St. Louis this morning to sign into law a $6 billion flood relief bill, and as he attended ceremonies for the signing, residents of the region were cleaning up after yet more rain. Side negotiations on the North America Free Trade Agreement hit a new snag today. Canadian Prime Minister Kim Campbell says she's not satisfied with the results of the current talks. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Negotiators for the United States, Canada, and Mexico are reported to have been near completion of their talks on side agreements to NAFTA, but Prime Minister Campbell is objecting to a formula that would penalize countries or companies that violate labor and environmental standards. Campbell's spokesman said she is not satisfied that Canada would not be ultimately exposed to trade sanctions. At the same time, the Mexican government is also complaining that the talks are at a breaking point because of provisions that would allow the U.S. and Canada to sue Mexico in its own courts over labor and environmental violations. An internal Mexican government document says this provision would violate the country's sovereignty. A Mexican trade official said the talks could be suspended indefinitely if the sovereignty issue is not addressed. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street just before the close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down slightly more than 13 points. This is NPR News. Wholesale prices fell 0.2% last month. The Labor Department says its Producer Price Index, which measures inflation at the wholesale level, registered the first back-to-back decline in 2 years. Energy costs dropped 1% in July, while food prices also fell by 0.1%. So far this year, wholesale inflation is running at an annual rate of 1.8%. For the fourth month in a row, retail sales were up in July. The Commerce Department says a big decline in auto purchases kept the increase down to just 0.1%. If car sales are removed from the figures, retail sales were up by 0.4%. A third attempt to get the Space Shuttle Discovery into orbit this morning failed. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The main engines on Discovery had ignited, but the shuttle's onboard computer shut down the launch with just 3 seconds remaining on the countdown clock. Officials say the computer had sensed a problem with the rate of fuel entering main engine number 2. There are 4 redundant sensors that measure the flow rate. three did not activate, but one did send up a red flag, causing the shutdown. NASA requires only one sensor to record a problem before scrubbing the liftoff. It's not yet known if the flow rate was the problem or if the sensor had just gone bad. Either way, it will be at least 2 weeks before another launch attempt can be made. Since the main engines did fire, they underwent the same stress as if the shuttle had gone into orbit. A complete refurbishing of those engines is now required, and that will cause the minimum 2-week delay. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
12 jurors have been picked for the Reginald Denny beating trial in Los Angeles. Henry Watson and Damian Williams are charged with 12 counts of attempted murder, robbery, assault, and mayhem. The two, who were black, are accused of beating white truck driver Reginald Denny during the riots last year in Los Angeles. 9 of the jurors that were picked are women, 4 are black, 2 Hispanic, and 1 is Asian. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There is a war against Western culture in parts of the Middle East. In Iran, Muslim militias patrol the streets, confiscating pop music and videos. In Egypt, tourists have been attacked by Islamic militants. These militants would also like to outlaw all artistic representations of the human form, along with books, movies, and poems that do not glorify Islam. There's even a campaign to tear down the Pharaoh's pyramids. Chris Hedges is the Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He's been writing about attacks on non-Islamic culture in the Middle East. Earlier today, we called him in Jerusalem. He told me about Iran's government-backed militias known as the Basijis.
They still are and were these sort of ragtag, motley-looking groups, primarily made up of workers, most people, mostly, of course, men from the lower class, groups of about 12, usually with a beat-up Jeep and a few AK-47s, and they just sort of appear out of nowhere and set up roadblocks and start stopping cars, asking questions, pulling people over, admonishing women who aren't dressed properly, looking in glove compartments to see if they can find music cassette tapes, this kind of stuff. That's what the normal Basiji patrol looks like and has looked like. However, in the last year, the government has been putting more resources in, and one of the things they've been doing is giving them uniforms, these sort of fatigue-type uniforms. So actually the look of the Basiji patrol is in a process of changing.
Say someone from the Basiji patrol finds a pop music cassette in the glove compartment of your car. How would you be punished for that?
It's not always clear. Sometimes they'll just confiscate them. Sometimes they'll if they find a ton of stuff, I think you're sent down to the police. Finding a music cassette is not sort of the worst offense. It's when they uncover drugs, alcohol, and certainly arms. Then these guys are in big trouble. And a lot of the men and women who go out, if they're not married, if they can't produce a marriage license, they can be harassed.
In an article that you wrote about the Basijis, you said that there were some women in the Basijis. That surprised me. Do they patrol?
Yeah, there are. It's a big organization. I mean, they have 3 million people throughout the country. And during the war, they were founded at the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, which started in 1980. And they were they kept 100 Basijis at the front at any one time. And these were people who would leave their jobs and volunteered to go to the front lines, and they were kept apart, and they were, singers would come down and entertain them, and they were sort of these elite, highly motivated shock troops. I mean, if the Iranians lost territory, they would just truck these Basijis in, and they suffered very high casualty rates. As part of this whole operation, they had women Basijis, and the women who were trained in, had military training, would go down to the front, but primarily do logistics in the rear, first aid, this kind of stuff. But yes, there are women Basijis, although they're less, you don't see them. They don't do set up patrols on the street. The women, I think, have taken somewhat less prominent role within the organization since the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988.
Have you ever been stopped?
I was stopped and took advantage of it. This is how the story started. I was stopped late one night and was only too happy to pull my car over and jump out and start interviewing them.
So. Well, how did they react to you interviewing them?
Fairly well, actually. I just happened to hit a group, I think, that was maybe a little more relaxed than others. They didn't want to give me their names, but they talked to me, and I stood with them on the side of the street for probably an hour or longer while they carried out their job. And, you know, I must admit, as a reporter, I sort of hit them with a lot of soft questions first so that I could at least strike up a dialogue with them. And it was a mixed group. I mean, I was sort of surprised. And then I arranged for them to... they had a friend of theirs who was a Basiji who was teaching at the university, and he, which is rare. Most of them are not particularly well-educated. And he had lived in the States for many years. I think he'd studied in the States. And they wanted me to meet him, and so they brought him. So I ended up sort of... And then through them, I ended up seeing the head of the Basiji, who used to be the chief of staff for the Revolutionary Guard. So I got a fair bit of time with them.
Did they search your car in addition to all of the interviews?
They didn't, actually. They I think maybe they were a little chagrined, or maybe they figured correctly I didn't have anything in there. But they didn't search my car. They searched everyone else's, but they didn't search mine.
Are a lot of people in Iran afraid of the Basijis, and are they much more cautious about what they keep in the car when they travel?
People are afraid of the Basijis, and you know, the Basijis aren't the only group that go out. You've got the moral police.
Who are the moral police?
The moral police are a section of the police that go out to make sure people aren't sleeping together if they're not married, or, you know, they'll raid a party, you know, they'll... take away. I mean, they in some ways do the same kind of job. The Basijis are like a militia, you know, an auxiliary group. They're like the committees to defend the revolution in Cuba. I mean, they're sort of popular bloc committees that work in conjunction with the authorities.
Is there an underground for the kinds of movies and music and books that are disapproved of by the Iranian government?
There's a huge underground, and that is, you know, and when I was speaking to the head, well, not only to the head, but to all of the Basijis, this was their great concern. They have a, you know, the Iranian Revolution, first and foremost, was a cultural revolution. It was meant to create an Islamic culture, which would create, you know, the new Islamic man, the new Islamic woman. And the fact that Western culture is so pervasive in the forms of videos and in the forms of music, and even the forms of books that are prohibited, the people like the Basijis, who are really the pillars of revolutionary Iran, feel very much under siege themselves. They feel that the West, which they see as wanting to destroy their Islamic society, is advancing, is gaining, is corrupting their youth. This is very much a cultural battle for them.
Well, we've been talking about Iran. Let me ask you to move over to Egypt, where you've also been reporting from recently. And in Egypt, there are similar militant groups trying to crack down on Western culture, anti-Islamic culture. But these groups are not approved of by the government. These groups would like to overthrow the government
right. In
Egypt. In fact, there's even been a militant campaign to destroy ancient monuments like the pyramids and the Sphinx. Why would those be under attack?
Well, Islam does not allow for the representation of the human form. So there is a theological justification for sort of turning against these monuments, these pharaonic monuments. The other problem is that the pharaonic monuments predate Islam, and I think that all of the cultures, the Hellenistic and the pharaonic cultures that came before Islam, are seen as idolatrous, as paganistic, and as something which must be rejected, so that people can find the answer, or find the truth, or find you know, the proper path through Islam. And one of the other arguments that they were saying is that the existence of these pharaonic monuments, and the care and preservation of the monuments actually can promote idolatry within Egypt and delude the power of Islam. And one of the examples that militants cited were these New Age groups that come over and stand around the pyramid at midnight and meditate in the sarcophagi, etc., as an example of the sort of power that these monuments can exert to throw people off the correct and proper path.
How far have the Islamic militants gotten in their attacks against the ancient monuments in Egypt?
Not very far. They put a bomb in one of the pyramids, a small bomb. The authorities uncovered another bomb in the Luxor Temple a few months ago. But there has not been, I mean, this is not, you know, there's a lot of things they want to do, not the least of which is overthrow the government, and going after the pharaonic monuments at this point is not very high on their list. I mean, they're attacking foreign tourists and Coptic Christians and government officials and all this kind of stuff. So this is just one of very many. One of many sort of plans they have. For the moment, I think it's more a matter of shunning the monuments. But they claim that if they come to power, they will destroy the pharaonic monuments. Whether they ever come to power and whether they do it when they come to power, I don't know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Hedges, Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times Middle East correspondent Chris Hedges. He's joining us on the phone from Jerusalem. Are the Islamic militants changing day-to-day life for people who don't share their beliefs in Egypt?
Oh, yes, very much so. You know, I mean, the difference, you mentioned Iran, you know, that there are movements in Egypt like Iran. I mean, there are, but of course in Iran, it comes primarily from the top down. The Basijis are marginalized people many of whom are unemployed or underemployed, and they you know, there's a payoff. They get a certain sort of power and privilege that otherwise society would deny them. In Egypt, it comes from the bottom up. These are really grassroots organizations. You know, they are revolutionary organizations. I mean, these people are whatever you think of their ideology, they're brave. There's a lot of self-sacrifice. There's a sense of sort of being within the struggle together. It's a utopian movement. There's a vision, because in many, especially poor areas in Egypt, there's a sort of a vacuum of government authority. The fundamentalists who are organized around the mosques will take over all sorts of roles within the neighborhood, including making sure that people, especially women, are in proper Islamic dress, that women are not harassed by young men, that they will patrol the marketplaces to make sure that thieves don't steal from poor vendors. They will intercede to make sure the debts are repaid. They've taken a very vital role in the day-to-day life of many Egyptians, and part of that role includes imposing their Islamic vision.
What is the government trying to do to stop the militant groups? Because the militant groups would like to overthrow the government in addition to making the other changes that you're describing.
The government has come down in the last few weeks pretty hard on these groups. They've closed down a lot of the mosques where they operated. They've thrown, we don't have a figure, but you know, hundreds, probably several thousand people in jail. They've instituted these special military courts that have been operating now since November. We've had 15 people hung since June. That's the largest number of people executed for political crimes in this century in Egypt. Police, there's increasing reports in the press about shootouts, and human rights groups contend that police now are being much more aggressive about firing on militant bands or militant safe houses that they have uncovered. We have a whole batch of new trials that are about to start. They've closed Islamic charity organizations. I mean, they've come down on these guys hard, and the militants themselves, when we speak to them, admit to having been hurt. But I think, and many people think, that because the government response focuses almost exclusively on the security angle, the root causes of this conflict, which are the political stagnation and the lack of employment opportunities and the sort of horrible poverty and lack of housing and government corruption, are still there. And so that while many of us expect to see a lull, we don't expect this movement to go away, and probably to get worse.
What is the connection between the Egyptian militants that you're describing and Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman? The Sheikh who's being held in New York. His followers have been implicated in the World Trade Center bombing and tied to the failed plot to bomb other targets in New York.
The Sheikh has been an important figure for the militant movement for, probably the last 15 or 20 years. I don't think he's involved in the day-to-day operations of the movement. I'm pretty certain that he isn't. I think the logistics and operations are run by others. But he is a spiritual leader.
Do you watch your own behavior really carefully when you're in Islamic countries now?
I have I have direct contacts with the militant groups. And in Egypt, for instance, they will take me into neighborhoods that they control. I have to meet them outside the neighborhood, and then they will put me in a taxi, usually with two young men, often whom are, by the way, are clean-shaven and dressed in Western clothes, but who are militants. And they'll drive me to a meeting, for instance. And these two men will stay with me the whole time and make sure that I'm not harassed in any way. And, of course, they also get to watch what I do. I think, especially from watching the Iranian Revolution, they've realized that while they don't trust the Western media can be useful for them. My problem doesn't come from the militants so much in Algeria, who I can meet with, or in Cairo, in Egypt, but in countries like the Sudan and Iran. I've been arrested twice this year in Iran, and I was arrested my last visit in the Sudan. Those are Islamic governments who understand that, that the Western media is not just going to print what they say. And then the control is pretty rigid. I mean, it's pretty tight and can be pretty nasty. So I might defy the Iranian government, as I did last time, by leaving the city without permission and writing a story that wasn't pre-approved, but you don't want to push them too far. Because they're, in a country like Iran, there's no embassy. There's nowhere, you have the Swiss handling our interests, but there's nowhere to turn. I mean, so in those countries, maybe I'm a little more careful, yeah.
So is that what you were arrested for, writing a story without being given official approval first?
In Iran, the last time, yeah. This was, I guess, June or... Hey, I can't remember. I think it was June, yeah. Yeah, I was up by the Caspian Sea writing a story about veterans from the 8-year war with Iraq who were committing suicide.
That was a really interesting story, and I was wondering how you stumbled on that.
I did stumble on it, and it was a classic example of just going out and finding out what was there, because I had sort of written all these heavy pieces about Islam, and I decided to go up to the Caspian and try and write something that might be amusing. I mean, I had no idea that this is what I was going to find, and went to this town on the sea 5 hours north of Tehran and started interviewing these guys. So first of all, there were a lot of young men, and it turns out they were veterans. And suddenly the issue of suicides came up. And the numbers of suicides were staggering, and the numbers of people that I interviewed who had close friends who had committed suicide or even who had attempted suicide themselves. I mean, I was literally just bumbling onto the story. But I was arrested in the course of doing it and held most of the night.
I guess it wasn't a popular story with the government, the fact that all these veterans were committing suicide.
No. It's not exactly what they had in mind when they gave me the visa.
Right. So can you go back in there now and continue writing, or would you have trouble getting in?
No, I did a story. I did stories out of there a year ago. I was banned for 12 months. And then I showed up in February at the airport with a valid visa, and they arrested me and held me all night. Wouldn't let me call, took my passport. And then in the morning, two Iranian cops came, you know, took me on either side of the arm, and I was deported. I mean, I was the only time in my life I've actually been deported. And my passport was given to Turkish airline officials, and the Iranians said I was not allowed to have it till I was in Istanbul. So I think the stories I wrote this time were a lot tougher than the ones I wrote the last time I got blacklisted, so I haven't called up and asked them, but...
right. So you're not going to bother to try to go there for a while?
No, I'll try.
You will try?
No, I've been trying to get into Syria for 2 years. I'm banned out of there, and I'm banned out of Iraq, too. So I keep trying, and they keep saying no. So
one final question. If youth in some Islamic countries are rebelling against militant Islam by listening to heavy metal records and watching American videos when they can get their hands on it, do you think that in a few years down the line, when the young people come into adulthood, that the pendulum's going to swing the other way?
No, I think in a country like Iran, I mean, I think in a country like Iran, the revolution's dead. It's over. Iran, you know, in the 1930s in the Soviet Union, I don't think, obviously the elite and those in power may have followed Stalin, but I think there was sort of a general discontent, and I think the same is true in Iran, which doesn't mean that the revolution, or revolutionary government is about to go down. But while at the same time you have this sort of rot internally within Iran, you have them working with militant groups, just as the Soviet Union was working with, loyalists in Spain, et cetera, and so the internal dynamics of a revolutionary society, at least for even a couple decades, don't necessarily interfere with the ability of that society to promote this revolutionary ideology, and I think that's what we're seeing in the Middle East.
Chris Hedges is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Dean Ornish has developed a regimen for reversing heart disease through a non-fat diet and stress reduction. It recently became the first non-surgical, non-pharmaceutical therapy for heart disease approved for reimbursement by a major insurance company. Coming up, we'll talk with Dr. Ornish. He also recommends his diet if you want to eat more, yet lose weight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Uncertainty around Sarajevo continues to threaten peace talks underway in Geneva. Bosnian Serb forces say they've lifted the siege of the city and left their positions on strategic mountaintops nearby. But Bosnia's Muslim president says that's not true, and he says because of that he'll continue to boycott the talks. A spokesman for the mediators of the peace talks says two important roads into Sarajevo have been opened, but it's unclear if aid can get in and people can get out. The mediators say they hope to restart the talks tomorrow. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is attempting to increase the pressure on the Serbian forces. He's declared the city's rescue is in the national interest of the U.S. His declaration marks a shift by the U.S. official. Barry Schwein reports.
Only 3 weeks ago, Christopher was telling Congress the U.S. is doing all that it can, within the limits of its national security interest, about the war in Bosnia. But last night, Christopher declared the city's survival in the U.S. national interest and said the Serbs had to do more than just vacate the mountains. They had to let relief get to the people inside Sarajevo. The change in tone could mean Christopher now has enough support among the European allies for NATO to bomb Serb positions. Or his statement could be designed to throw a scare into the Serbs. Past threats haven't succeeded. This time the U.S. may mean business. Christopher said an attack could be launched quickly once a decision is taken. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
U.S. troops wounded at least three Somalis today when they fired at a group of protesters. Witnesses say the soldiers opened fire after they were hit with stones. U.N. officials, however, say the troops behaved correctly by firing over the heads of demonstrators. The protest attracted thousands of people. Tens of thousands of unemployed parents on welfare will have to go to work if they want to continue collecting a monthly check. Jean Brian Johnson reports that this provision of the Family Support Act of 1988 goes into effect this fall.
The requirements target the 371,000 two-parent families receiving aid to families with dependent children. Under the law, the principal wage earner in the household, typically a father who'd been laid off, will have to spend 16 hours a week working in the community. In exchange for a share of the family's welfare benefits, the recipient will tackle chores, such as mowing the lawn at a public school or helping out at a nursing home. Critics say the requirements will force states to divert money from education and job training and pour it into creating work activity with no long-term benefits for poor families. The Clinton administration tried to postpone implementation until 1995, but the delay was dropped from the economic package signed into law earlier this week. This is Jean Brian Johnson in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed lower today, losing 14 points, finishing up at 3569.09. This is NPR News. President Clinton signed a $6 billion flood relief package into law this morning. The president signed the bill during an elaborate ceremony in St. Louis. During the signing, the president said he was pleased with how Washington responded to the disaster, but he said that effort paled in comparison to the work of the area's residents. He also promised to make sure that the government is improved to make it even more responsive in the future. The Commerce Department says retail sales were up slightly in July by 0.1%. However, department officials say if a big decline in auto purchases is removed, sales were up by a stronger 0.4%. It was the fourth month in a row to post an increase. Meanwhile, the Labor Department says prices at the wholesale level fell in July. Steve Beckner of Market News Service reports.
The producer price price index for finished goods fell 0.2% last month. Excluding volatile food and energy, the so-called core rate of producer price inflation rose, but only by 0.1%. The news helped further strengthen bond prices and lower long-term interest rates. Energy prices fell a full percent in July, while food was down 0.1%. Falling tobacco prices also helped hold down the overall index. The main factor causing the core rate to rise slightly was higher car prices, which were up 0.8% after seasonal adjustment. Actual car prices were only up 0.1%, but the Labor Department statisticians had been expecting a drop in prices with the end of the model year. The report continued a recent trend toward lower inflation figures. In the past 12 months, wholesale prices have risen just 1.3%, but most analysts are expecting tomorrow's consumer price index release to show a bit more rapid pace. This is Steve Beckner in Washington.
The largest U.S. congressional delegation ever to visit Vietnam since the end of the war, they arrived in Hanoi today. The lawmakers are investigating the potential for U.S. business investment if Washington lifts its embargo against Hanoi. This is NPR News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. There is considerable resistance within the medical establishment to alternative therapies, so it was front-page news a few weeks ago when a so-called lifestyle therapy for heart disease was approved for reimbursement by the nation's largest provider of health insurance. The heart program was developed by my guest, Dr. Dean Ornish. He's conducted several studies which show heart disease can be reversed through a strict vegetarian diet in conjunction with stress reduction. His program is controversial within the medical establishment. Some doctors say few people could stick with such a dramatic change in diet and lifestyle. Dr. Ornish is the author of the best-selling book Reversing Heart Disease. His new book elaborates on the diet he recommends, which he says is also good for losing weight. The book is called Eat More, Weigh Less. I asked him about the larger significance of his program's acceptance by a major insurance company.
Well, you know, the major determinant of how doctors practice medicine is what's reimbursed. And ultimately, that goes back even to affecting medical education. You know, doctors do what insurance companies reimburse them to do, and ultimately we get trained to do what we get paid to do. So I think it's a real breakthrough because it'll enable many doctors and therefore many patients to have access to the kinds of programs that we're developing that otherwise they wouldn't have.
Do you know what happened behind the scenes before this decision was made, and were you involved with politicking behind the scenes?
Well, I've been talking with insurance companies for a number of years, to no avail until now, because they haven't been willing to pay for lifestyle programs because they view them as adding to their costs rather than savings. And also the scientific data that we've been accumulating in a series of rigorous scientific studies over the last 16 years weren't considered convincing enough until now. But there's a real convergence of forces that is making change inevitable. And like so many crises, the change can be for better or for worse. I'm hoping that it's going to, that at least in part, it can go in a good direction. And part of those forces are the exponential rise in healthcare costs. And efforts to contain those costs really haven't worked very well. The real theme of my work, if you have to categorize it into one sentence, is that if you deal with the underlying cause of the problem, it's ultimately more effective. And if you literally or figuratively bypass the problem, literally with surgery, like bypass surgery, or figuratively with drugs and other operations, then the problem tends to keep coming back again. You get a whole new set of problems or side effects that you hadn't counted on, or you're faced with painful choices. And that's as true on a health policy level as it is on an individual level. And the efforts to contain healthcare costs in the past really haven't dealt with the underlying cause. They've literally bypassed the problem by just trying to shorten hospital stays and shift from inpatient to outpatient surgery and limit the amount of money they'd pay doctors, none of which really dealt with the more fundamental questions of why people get sick. And so it really hasn't made much of a dent in the rise in costs.
Give us a very brief, basic description of your program to reverse heart disease or prevent it.
The program is really designed to deal with the cause of the problem, and it's based on the idea that that there's a causal chain of events that leads to heart disease, or really to most problems, in this case, heart disease. And I might just digress a moment and say that we're focusing on heart disease, but it's by no means limited. The benefits are by no means limited to heart disease. It's a good model for demonstrating how powerful a lifestyle program can be. You know, we tend to think of advances in medicine as being a new drug, a new surgical technique, a new high-tech operation. And sometimes we have a hard time believing that such simple and low-cost and low-tech interventions can be so powerful. The program is designed to address these root causes of why people get heart disease. So it includes a low-fat vegetarian diet, which is devoid of animal products except for skim milk, non-fat yogurt, or egg whites because they're very low in fat and have virtually no cholesterol. It includes moderate exercise, walking 20 or 30 minutes a day or for an hour three times a week. A variety of different, what we euphemistically call stress management techniques, various stretching and breathing and meditation and imagery and relaxation techniques, which we ask people to do for an hour or so a day, and group support sessions. You know, I call them stress management techniques because in the very first study that my colleagues and I did I was 17 years ago when I was a medical student, we called it the effects of yoga and a vegetarian diet on reversing heart disease. And a very friendly cardiologist came up to me and put his arm around me in a very avuncular way, said, you know, I'd like to refer patients to you, but I don't think I can do it unless we get a new title for your project. So we called it the effects of stress management training and dietary changes on heart disease. And you know, when you're trying to build bridges between different worlds, the terminology becomes very important.
So what results have you gotten with your program?
On a physical level, we measured improvements, and they occurred much more quickly than we had once thought. Within a few days or a few weeks at most, most patients, even those who had severe heart disease and intense and frequent chest pain or angina, noticed a marked reduction in how frequently and how severe those pains were. On average, our patients in actually both of the more recent studies reported a 91% reduction in the amount of chest pain or angina, and most of that occurred in the first week or so. That's a powerful motivator for someone. And, you know, for someone who can't work because they get chest pain or have sex without getting pain or shower or shave or even walk across the street before the light changes without getting pain, and within a few days or a few weeks they can do all of those things with virtually no pain, that's a powerful motivator. But we found that not only were patients feeling better, but they really were better in ways that we could measure. We found that within a month, the blood flow to the heart improved as measured by what's called thallium scans. We found the ability of the heart to pump blood became more normal as measured what's called radionuclide ventriculography or gated blood pool scans. Within a year, we found that even severely blocked arteries became measurably less blocked using a technique called computer-analyzed coronary arteriography. And within 4 years, we're finding, in general, there's even more reversal than after 1 year. When I was a medical student, the so-called natural history of heart disease, in other words, when someone got a heart problem, we were told that at best you could slow down the rate at which they got worse. But they were going to get worse. It was just a matter of how quickly they got worse. And in the control groups of our studies, that's in fact what we found, that the control group, who were making the conventional recommendations that the Heart Association and others would advise, on average, the majority of those patients got worse and worse over time, whereas the patients who followed the more intensive lifestyle program that we've developed got better and better. And that really gives many people new hope and new choices to know that they don't have to get worse, and in fact, they can often get better.
Is there
much more quickly than we had once thought?
Is there a place in your thinking for drugs and for surgery?
Well, sure, drugs and surgery, I think, have a place. I went to India in 1979 with a man named Swami Satchidananda, who's a spiritual teacher that I learned most of these things from. And I was a medical student, and so we were going around to the different alternative kinds of medical interventions that they have in India, Ayurveda and homeopathic medicines and nature cure and all these different things. And I got a terrible case of amoebic dysentery, and I kept getting sicker and sicker. And every time I'd go to one of these places, I'd try the local remedies, and I just got worse and worse. And finally, I said, to hell with it, and I took some antibiotics, and I got well the next day. So I came back from India with this very healthy respect for Western medicine. You know, if somebody comes into the emergency room with crushing chest pain, saying, "Doc, get this elephant off my chest," I don't feed them, you know, vegetables and broccoli and tell them to meditate. In a crisis, drugs and surgery can often be life-saving. But they don't really, at best, they don't deal with the cause of the problem. So once someone is stabilized, that's the time to then say, "Okay, Mr. Jones or Ms. Smith, how did you get in this situation? And what can we do to make sure you don't have to go through this again?"
My guest is Dr. Dean Ornish. His program for reversing heart disease with a strict vegetarian diet and stress reduction has been approved for reimbursement by a major insurance company. It's the first so-called lifestyle heart program to get the approval of a major insurer. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Dean Ornish, and your new book is actually a book about the diet that you recommend for people with heart problems or people who want to prevent heart problems. The book is called Eat More, Weigh Less. And, I mean, the diet is basically a no-fat diet. It's a vegetarian diet. And you tell people basically that they could eat as much vegetables, grains, fruits as they want to.
Well, the book is really a bit of a conspiracy, you might say. If I wrote a book called How to Help Reverse Heart Disease and Prevent Breast Cancer and Stroke and Osteoporosis and Diabetes and Hypertension and lots of bad things, not many people would be reading it. So it is true, though, that you can eat more and weigh less. But when people get into that, they find that it's really much more than that. I wrote the book when a year and a half ago, the National Institutes of Health came out with a report saying that most weight loss diets just don't work, that within a year, two-thirds of the people who've lost weight have regained it all, and within 5 years, virtually everybody had, say 97% had. And their conclusion, many very respected weight loss experts at Harvard and other places began to say, well, if the pattern of losing weight and regaining it is itself harmful, and if virtually nobody who loses weight can keep it off, maybe we shouldn't even tell people to try. There's a nihilism that's kind of creeping into medicine. We also see it now in the cholesterol arena. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of months ago that said if you go on what they call the low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, your blood cholesterol levels come down by only 5%. And their conclusion was, why even bother? Just put everybody on drugs. Or why even bother to screen to see if people have high cholesterol if you can't do much with diet? Well, in our research, we looked at our data, and we found that the average cholesterol level in our patients went down 37%, more than with cholesterol-lowering drugs, but without the costs and side effects of those drugs. We also found that the average patient lost 22 pounds during the study, even though they were not told to try to lose weight. In our study, we asked people to follow the diet, but it wasn't a diet based on deprivation. It was one based on the type of food, not the amount of food. We said within these guidelines, you can eat whenever you're hungry, you can eat until you're full, and still the average patient lost 22 pounds, and they've been able to keep most of that off over a period of now 7 years or more.
You've basically divided up food into three groups, and I'm asking you this both for people who are interested in weight, but also people who are interested in health. I want to get your views on this. You've divided food into three different groups that each carry a different recommendation for the amount you can eat of them. Can you go over those food groups, how you've divided them?
Well, the foods that you can eat whenever you're hungry until you're full and whenever you want are primarily plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, beans, mm-hmm. non-fat dairy, egg whites, things like that. And the foods to avoid are the high-fat foods, the meat and high-fat, high-cholesterol foods that people are most familiar with. And the foods to eat, a little more moderately are the ones that are plant-based foods but tend to be high in fat, like tofu-based products and so on.
Your new book is about eating more and weighing less. Are different kinds of calories processed differently by the body?
Yes, they are. And that's an important factor for people because many people don't understand that. Your body converts dietary fat into body fat very efficiently. It's part of an adaptive response. For the last 10,000 years, the major problem as a species has been getting enough calories, not too many of them. And so our bodies have evolved to deal with scarcity rather than with abundance. So fat is a very efficient way for your body to store energy. There are 9 calories per gram of fat and only 4 in protein and carbohydrate. So when you eat fat, your body converts it into body fat very easily. Almost all of the calories go straight to your body. Also, fat, as we mentioned, has over twice as many calories per gram as protein and carbohydrate. So if you shift from a diet that's 40% fat to one that's, say, 10% fat, even if you eat the exact amount of food, you're still going to be consuming far fewer calories. And those fat calories are going to be less likely to be converted into body fat. The other evolutionary adaptation is if you simply reduce the amount of food that you eat, like you do on most weight loss diets, without changing the type of food, then your body thinks you're starving. And again, you've evolved to deal with scarcity. So if you reduce your calories by a third without changing the type of calories, your body's metabolism will slow down. So at first you begin to lose weight, but then your metabolism slows down by a third to try to hold on to those calories so you don't starve to death. Well, if you're starving to death, that's something that can help you survive. If you're trying to lose weight, you're going to stop losing weight. And when your metabolism slows down, besides burning calories more slowly, most people find they feel tired and sluggish and aren't thinking very clearly, kind of fuzzy, which makes it even harder to stay on a diet like this. If you change the type of food, without reducing the amount of food, if you reduce the amount of fat in your diet sufficiently, as I recommend, then your metabolism doesn't slow down. Many people find it even goes up. And then rather than feeling tired and sluggish, they usually have more energy, can think more clearly, and have an overall improved sense of well-being. And they're not hungry.
You recommend no more than 2 ounces of alcohol a day. 2 ounces is not very much.
Well, actually, 2 ounces is quite a lot.
We're talking about a beverage or of alcohol?
2 ounces of pure alcohol.
So how much is that in terms of beer or wine?
Well, an ounce of alcohol usually translates into a can of beer, like a 12-ounce can of beer, a 4-ounce glass of wine. An ounce, you know, kind of a shot of hard liquor. So it's like 2 drinks, 2 glasses of wine, 2 cans of beer a day.
Oh, well, that's not bad.
I guess it depends on who you talk to. I think it's better, actually, to avoid alcohol altogether if you can. Because
what's the problem with alcohol?
Well, if you're trying to lose weight, alcohol not only gives you calories, but it also slows down the rate at which you burn calories. You know, a beer belly is just that, because it makes your body hold on to those calories. It just kind of gives you a double whammy. It not only gives you calories, but it also helps your body burn those calories about a third more slowly. And, you know, alcohol has problems. Sometimes people say, well, gee, I thought that people who drink in moderation live longer than those who don't drink at all, or those who drink to excess. And in a way, that's true, but I think it's not the alcohol per se. There are a number of studies that have come out that have shown that people who feel socially isolated, and when they say socially isolated, they don't mean necessarily living alone, but do you have someone that loves you? Do you have someone that you could call that would take you to the hospital if you got sick, and someone who'd loan you money if you were really in dire straits? And if the answer is no, study after study is showing in different parts of the world that people who feel lonely and isolated have somewhere between 2 and 5 times the mortality rates from not only heart disease, but from all causes, when compared to people who have a sense of connection and community in their lives. You know, the real epidemic in our culture, I think, is not just heart disease and obesity and so on. It's what I might call emotional or spiritual heart disease.
My guest is Dr. Dean Ornish. He's created a program for reversing heart disease through a strict vegetarian diet and stress reduction. His new book focuses on his diet, which he also recommends for losing weight. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, another execution date has been set in Texas for Gary Graham, and his attorneys are trying to get him another trial. We have a piece on the people who work on death row, a couple of conversations with prison guards. David Mulpas is covering the story of the drought in the Southeast. We have more on the flap about whether or not Marines may be married. And we will have several of our NPR commentators who watched the Perseid meteor shower last night talk about it, tell us what they saw and what they thought.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Dr. Dean Ornish. His program for reversing heart disease with a strict vegetarian diet and stress reduction has been approved for reimbursement by a major insurance company. It's the first so-called lifestyle heart program to get the approval of a major insurer. One of the things that some doctors have criticized you for is creating a diet that would be impossible to stick to. How realistic do you think your diet is, and what's your response to doctors who say, no, nobody could stick to this?
Well, when I first began doing this work, it was very hard even to get funding from the National Institutes of Health and other agencies for that very reason, because they said, you know, no one's going to follow this program, so you have an untestable hypothesis. And doesn't matter how elegant your test measures are, like, you know, PET scans and so on, if no one's going to follow the program, you know, what good is it? And I said, well, let's find out. And they said, no, we won't do that. So we initially funded our work through private foundations, and then later the NIH gave us funding to continue it. What we're learning is that it's not that simple changes are easy and big changes are hard. If that were, people would take their medications and as their doctors prescribe them, and yet most people don't do that. What we're finding is that, paradoxically, even though it may be counterintuitive to a lot of people, it's actually easier to make big changes than to make small ones, even though that goes against the conventional wisdom. And, you know, doctors say, well, that's crazy. I can't even get my patients to eat less red meat. You expect them to be vegetarian and do meditation and yoga and exercise and quit smoking and talk about their feelings in a group. Nobody will do that. But in fact, the patients in our study have been doing that for 7 years or more. And if you ask them why, they'll say, okay, first of all, when I make small changes, I get a sense of deprivation, they'll say. I have the sense of not being able to do or to eat everything that I want, but they're not making changes big enough to get much benefit. Their blood pressure, their weight, their cholesterol really don't come down very much. If they have heart disease, their chest pain usually gets worse, and their underlying blockages in their arteries become more blocked over time. So they have the deprivation and the hassle, but they don't really get much benefit. On the other hand, when people make the kind of comprehensive big changes that I recommend, they generally feel so much better so quickly that the choices become much clearer to them. And for many people, they're worth making.
You are becoming very well known. Your earlier book was a bestseller. You have your new book, Eat More, Weigh Less. I'd like to hear of what you think the pros and cons are of the kind of media recognition you're getting. On the one hand, I'm sure you want the best-selling books and the media recognition because you want people to find out about your program. On the other hand, I'm wondering if there's a downside to the kind of doctor celebrity route.
Oh, there's a very big downside, and the more recognition that someone gets, the less credible they're often seen as being. For me, whatever ego needs one gets in terms of being on radio or TV or magazines, those get those 15 minutes of fame, in a sense, get satisfied very quickly. And it's a fairly empty experience, as so many of the celebrities that I think that you interview will tell you over time, if they're honest with themselves. On the other hand, for me, One interview with you on Fresh Air, and I reach more people that with information that may help them than I'll see in 1,000 lifetimes working with people one-on-one. So that I find enormously gratifying. And, my last book, I wanted to call Opening Your Heart. The publisher said, no, we need to call it Dr. Dean Ornish's Program for Reversing Heart Disease and put a picture of you on the cover and all of that. That makes me enormously uncomfortable. And yet I realize that that may be what it takes in a celebrity-driven culture like ours to get the information out there. If that's what it takes, then that's a price I've been willing to pay, but there is a clear downside to it.
Dean Ornish, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Dean Ornish has a new book called Eat More, Weigh Less. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two great actors starring in summer films. We'll hear from Lawrence Fishburne, star of What's Love Got to Do with It and Searching for Bobby Fischer. And we'll feature an interview with Joe Mantegna, also starring in Searching for Bobby Fischer. It's part of our weekly series of interviews from the archives. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.